Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, John Russell, and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Yohani Cepeda Freites says it has been a struggle to educate Latinos in the United States about their growing strength as voters. People feel like their vote does not count and their vote does not matter, she said. Cepeda Freites owns an eatery. She also is the only Latino on the 6-member city council in Reading, Pennsylvania. More than 50 years ago, a group of Puerto Ricans moved to Reading to work in agriculture. Since then, the city's Latino population has grown 65%. They now outnumber Reading's traditional base of white Protestants with German ancestry. Cepeda Freites was born in New York City of parents from the Dominican Republic. She told VOA that some of her non-Latino neighbors suspect she is not a U.S. citizen. They accused her of buying her papers after she was elected to the local government. Suspicion from whites and indifference from Latinos may explain why Reading has never had a Hispanic mayor. Eddie Moran is vice president of the Reading School Board. He wants to become the city's first Hispanic mayor in elections later this year. He also is watching the U.S. presidential election campaign. I think next year the Latino community is going to make a difference in this electoral campaign, he said. The 32 million Latinos registered to vote in the 2020 presidential election will make them the largest racial or ethnic voting bloc in the country. They just may decide if President Donald Trump is reelected. For Democrats, it's critical that they hold on to the Latino vote, and for Republicans that they gain support among Latino voters, said G. Terry Madonna. He directs the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. 73% of Latinos nationwide plan to vote or think they may vote for the Democratic Party's presidential nominee in 2020. That information comes from a recent study of likely voters by the television broadcaster Univision. Some political observers say the most important areas to watch next year are parts of Texas along the Mexican border, Orange County in Florida, and Las Vegas in Nevada. All these areas have many Hispanic voters. Then there is the eastern state of Pennsylvania, which has experienced a 28% increase in its Hispanic population over the past 10 years. Pennsylvania chose Trump over Democrat Hillary Clinton in the 2016 elections. Pennsylvania, Texas, Florida, and Nevada may influence the election results next year. Many Latinos have moved to Reading, the once wealthy, former industrial city, to join other Latinos. In 2011, the New York Times reported that Redding was the poorest city in the nation. The area's Latino community has spread out along what is now known as the Route 222 Latino Corridor. It makes up more than 50% of Pennsylvania's Hispanic population. Moran and Cepeda Freites spent a recent weekend meeting with political supporters talking to undecided voters. They marched in Redding's first Puerto Rican parade and street festival. Businesswoman Angel Figueroa was the first Puerto Rican elected to Redding's city council in 2002. She organized the parade and festival. Figueroa points to Redding's importance in the 2020 election. With all of the hate and rhetoric that's been going on, Figueroa said, I think it's time that as a group that we send a message to both political parties. While some Hispanics blame Trump for divisive language, about 30% of Americans of Hispanic ancestry voted for him in 2016. He has many supporters in Redding, like Nancy Rodriguez and Junior Cruz Morales. I support him because I've seen more opportunities for Latinos, and he's been focusing more on the Latino community, Rodriguez said. Her husband, Cruz Morales, agreed, We voted for Donald Trump, and he's doing a good job. I'm not sure if he's going to get 4 more years, but if he does, we welcome that. Unemployment among Hispanics nationally is a low 4.2%. Trump has claimed credit for that number repeatedly at his political campaign events. Trump won Pennsylvania in 2016 by less than 1%, the narrowest margin in a presidential election in the state in 176 years. Hillary Clinton easily won Redding. Many Democrats say they are sure that the city's Latino voters will support their party's nominee next year. Others are not so sure. Dissatisfaction with the president will not be enough to get Latinos to vote, said Grecia Lima. She is the political director for Community Change Action in Washington. She added that getting Latinos to vote will require one-on-one contacts with the candidate's trusted messengers. I'm Susan Shand.
Imagine you want to talk about what someone is doing. Perhaps you want to add information about where that action is happening. This week on Everyday Grammar, we will explore how English speakers use progressive verbs with expressions of place. Here are two examples. You might hear someone say, "He is working outside." Or the person could say, "He is outside working." Sentences like these will be the subject of our report today. But first, let us begin with a few definitions.
Progressive verbs show that an action is in progress during a certain period of time. Progressive verbs are sometimes called continuous verbs. The form of the progressive is be plus ing. This is known as the present participle. If you want to learn more about progressive verbs, you can find a report about them on our website. Expressions of place are words or groups of words that show where something is happening. Examples include phrases or terms with the words in, on, or at, such as in her office, at the bookstore, and so on. Expressions of place can sometimes move in a sentence and even come in between progressive verbs, as we will find.
Imagine the following situation. You are watching a television show about an American family. Perhaps the actors say the following lines.
What is Dad doing?
He is sleeping upstairs.
Now imagine the exchange is a little different, as in,
where is Dad?
He is upstairs, sleeping.
You might notice that the second speaker used the exact same words in both examples, but the words were in a different order. You heard, he is sleeping upstairs, and he is upstairs sleeping. In other words, the expression of place comes between the auxiliary verb be and the ing form. In our examples, the word upstairs comes between is and sleeping. Now, let's consider a more difficult example. Imagine you hear the actors in the same fictional television show say the following.
What was Dad doing when you came home?
He was working on a project in the garage.
Now consider the following.
Where was Dad when you came home?
He was in the garage working on a project.
Once again, you might notice that the speaker changed the order of the words. The expression of place in the garage came between the words was and working.
You might be asking yourself if there is a difference in meaning in the two sentences. The basic meaning is the same. However, there is a small difference in the focus. So, if we examine our earlier example,
what was Dad doing when you came home?
He was working on a project in the garage.
The focus of both the question and the answer is on what the dad was doing. The other example went like this.
Where was Dad when you came home?
He was in the garage working on a project.
The focus of both the question and the answer is on where Dad is. If this subject seems like it might be difficult, do not fear. To begin with, you can try to find examples that you hear in movies or television shows. Ask yourself if the expression of place comes after the progressive verb or between the auxiliary verb be and the ing form. This idea will help you understand sentences that might at first seem strange to you. But these sentences can become clearer if you find the progressive verb and expression of place. That's all for now. Next week at 10 a.m., we will be in this production studio recording a new Everyday Grammar. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. We've been discussing the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. He was America's third president, elected in 1800. In our last program, we talked about the dispute between Jefferson and the Chief Justice of the United States. Jefferson believed the Constitution gave Congress the right to decide the country's laws. But Chief Justice John Marshall believed the Supreme Court had the final say. The two men's beliefs were tested in a case called Marbury versus Madison. John Marshall's arguments won. He wrote a decision saying the Supreme Court had the power to rule on the laws that Congress passed. The Supreme Court did not act on that power during Jefferson's administration. But John Marshall's decision did help establish the role of the Supreme Court in the American government. The Marbury versus Madison case is one of the important legacies of Jefferson's presidency. But historian Joseph Ellis says it was not the only one.
The major achievement of Jefferson's presidency is the Louisiana Purchase, which is a lot of luck, as well as his willingness to take advantage of the luck.
The story of the Louisiana Purchase begins with France and Spain. The two European countries wanted to limit the power of the United States. So in 1800, Spain and France entered into a secret treaty. In the treaty, Spain gave France control of a large area in North America called the Louisiana Territory. The Louisiana Territory stretched north to south from the Gulf of Mexico to Canada, and it stretched east to west from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. The area was important not only for its large size, it also included some valuable navigation features, including where the Mississippi River opened into the Gulf of Mexico. Napoleon Bonaparte ruled France at that time. Jefferson did not want Napoleon in North America. He felt the French presence was a threat to the peace of the United States. He decided to try to buy parts of the Louisiana Territory, especially around the mouth of the Mississippi River near the city of New Orleans. Jefferson sent James Monroe to Paris as a special negotiator. But Monroe never had a chance to offer the American position. Napoleon had decided to sell everything to the Americans. He told his finance minister to give up Louisiana, all of it. Napoleon needed money for a war with Britain. James Monroe was happy to negotiate the purchase of Louisiana. They agreed on a price of 80 million francs for all the land drained by the Great Mississippi River and all its many streams. The Louisiana Purchase nearly doubled the size of the United States at that time. It included the present-day states of Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. It stretched into parts of Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and Louisiana. The Louisiana Purchase also opened the Mississippi River to American commerce and travel. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says that as a result of this access, the Louisiana Purchase fueled the country's economic expansion in the 19th century. And Mr. O'Shaughnessy says the Louisiana Purchase created more opportunities for Americans to own land.
It was very important to Jefferson because he really wanted every free member of society to be able to own land. He regarded land ownership as, in many ways, essential to someone's independence and their ability, therefore, to participate in a republican government.
But both Mr. O'Shaughnessy and historian Joseph Ellis say the Louisiana Purchase went against Jefferson's beliefs about central government. Joseph Ellis says that in many ways, Jefferson's presidency aimed to make the federal government almost invisible and to limit the president's power.
And the Louisiana Purchase is the most authoritative executive action in American presidential history. One president decides to buy the Midwest, and he does it unilaterally.
Historians say the Louisiana Purchase is one example of Jefferson's contradictory character, in which he says one thing but does another. Andrew O'Shaughnessy adds that Jefferson made trade-offs. When he bought Louisiana, Jefferson used presidential power in a way that was not specifically permitted by the Constitution. But Mr. O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was also looking to the higher good. In the case of the Louisiana Purchase, the good of improving the country's political health. Federalists in the early 1800s also questioned Jefferson's decision to buy Louisiana. They feared it would weaken the power of the states of the Northeast. Federalist leaders made a plan to form a new government of those states. But to succeed, they needed the state of New York. Their plan for a new government led to another memorable episode in American history. Aaron Burr was vice president during Thomas Jefferson's first term. Burr became a candidate for New York governor. The Federalists believed Burr would win the election, become governor, and support their plan. But Federalist leader Alexander Hamilton did not trust Burr. The two had been enemies for a long time. Hamilton made some strong statements against Burr during the election campaign in New York. The comments later appeared in several newspapers. Burr lost the New York election. The Federalist plan for a new government of northeastern states died. New York historian Valerie Paley says Burr heard about Hamilton's strong comments. He was offended.
He called him something like despicable. It hinged on a word, one word, and a word as simple as despicable.
Burr asked Hamilton to admit or deny the comments. Hamilton refused. The two men exchanged more notes. Burr was not satisfied with Hamilton's answers. He believed Hamilton had attacked his honor. Burr demanded a duel. A duel is a fight, usually with guns. Valerie Paley says in those days, gentlemen often used duels to settle rivalries and defend their honor.
So it wasn't so much these men dueled to kill. They would purposely miss their shots, and then everything, the air would be cleared.
Hamilton opposed duels, yet he agreed to fight Burr on July 11th, 1804. The two men met at Weehawken, New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from New York City. The duel would take place by the water's edge at the bottom of a high rock wall. The guns were loaded. Burr and Hamilton took their places. One of Hamilton's friends explained the rules. "Are you ready, gentlemen?" he asked. Both answered yes. There was a moment of silence. He gave the signal. Burr and Hamilton raised their guns. Two shots split the air. Hamilton raised up on his toes.
then fell to the ground. Burr remained standing. He looked at Hamilton with regret, then left. Hamilton died the next day. He was not yet 50. Valerie Paley says Hamilton's story is almost like a television or newspaper drama.
He was extremely attractive, and he had such a romantic story. Here he is, the immigrant boy from the West Indies, made good, comes to New York, goes to King's College, becomes a sort of a self-taught lawyer, becomes aide-de-camp to Washington, all sorts of extraordinary things, marries so well, and also has this vision of what modern America might become, and in many ways was able to implement at least an early bit of that vision before his death.
Hamilton had made a big impact on the United States. He had created a national bank and influenced many government policies. Newspapers throughout the nation reported his death. Most people accepted the news calmly. To them, it was simply the sad end to an old private dispute. In the months after Hamilton's death, the nation prepared for the next presidential election. Once again, the Republican Party chose Thomas Jefferson as its candidate for president. But the Republicans refused to support Aaron Burr for vice president again. Instead, they chose George Clinton. Clinton had served as governor of New York 7 times. The Federalist Party chose Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina as its candidate for president. It chose Rufus King of New York to be its vice presidential candidate. The campaign was quiet. In those days, candidates did not make many speeches. Republican pamphlets told of the progress made during the past 4 years. The former Federalist administration raised taxes, they said. Jefferson ended many of the taxes. The Federalists borrowed millions of dollars. Jefferson borrowed none. And Jefferson got the Louisiana Territory without going to war. The Federalists could not dispute these facts. They expected that Jefferson would be reelected, but they were sure their candidate would get as many as 40 electoral votes. The results shocked the Federalists. Jefferson received 162 electoral votes. Pinckney received just 14. One man tried to explain the meaning of Jefferson's great victory. He was John Quincy Adams, son of former President John Adams. President Adams had been a firm Federalist. This is what his son said. "The power of Jefferson's administration rests on a strong majority of the American people. The president has great popular support. His re-election shows that the experiment of the Federalists has failed. It never can and never will be brought to life again. To try to bring it back would be foolish. It would be like trying to put life into a body that has been buried for years." After the election of 1804, only 7 Federalists remained in the United States Senate. Only 25 remained in the House of Representatives. Thomas Jefferson would be president for another 4 years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.